It's been 2 weeks since the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. The violence there has renewed conversations about racial relations, freedom of speech, and radicalization. Shannon Martinez of Athens knows a lot about that last one. She was a skinhead for several years, but she is not one anymore. And Shannon joins me from Athens. Good morning.
Good morning.
Just a note to our listeners, parts of this conversation may not be suitable for young ears. Now, Shannon, you actually joined a skinhead group when you were a teenager, right? Quite young.
Yes, when I was in between 15 and 16 years old.
So let's walk through what happened then and how you ended up joining that group. Because as I understand it, you yourself were considered yourself to be liberal at that point.
When we would sit around the dinner table, my family tended towards much more conservative politics and arguments, whereas I took the much more liberal view. I loved the Beatles as a middle schooler and the culture of the 60s.
You described your family, I'm sorry to interrupt,
sure.
You described your family as having acceptable middle-class racism. What does that mean?
I don't mean that from a personal point of view at this point in my life, but the racism that is so much a part of what we deem as acceptable, where we stay silent now, where it's, you know, little jokes that involve race or little derogatory remarks if somebody cuts you off in traffic, or it's okay to start talking about property values diminishing as members of different races move into an all-white neighborhood, things like that, that they found overt racism to be abhorrent and said so. But on the other hand, there was this other conversation that was always going on.
So you went from not really buying into that acceptable racism, which again is a euphemism, to
I was in a breakdance group as a little girl a bunch of multicultural people.
Right. So how did you then end up being in a hate group?
Just before my 15th birthday, I went to a party with some friends. During that time, I was being drawn towards counterculture movements, skateboarders, and then from there, like punk rock. I never quite felt like I fit in my family. I felt like there was a lot of perfectionism that was part of my family that I never really could quite measure up. Real or perceived, that was how I felt in my family. And so I didn't have a deep, strong sense of belonging. And then we moved from where I had grown up outside of Philadelphia to rural Michigan, just over the border of Ohio. And I lost all sense of personal identity that I had been building since I was young, coupled with the fact that I didn't feel a strong connection and identity as part of my family. And so I started being drawn to like skateboard culture and then punk rock culture, like looking for identity outside of myself. I went to a party when I was 14, just shy of my 15th birthday. And at that party, I was raped by two men. And that was how I lost my virginity. It would take me another 10 years to even be able to frame what happened to me that way. I understand now how the brain deals with trauma and why that would be so. But instead of going to my parents, I knew on some level that if I told them that had happened, that I would be in trouble because I had lied about where I had gone and I had been drinking. And I know that the core of who I was couldn't accept that anyone placing blame on me for this outrage, for this trauma that had happened to me, that it wasn't my fault. And that began a cycle of deep self-loathing, and because I had all of this unprocessed trauma. And so I just began to just hate myself and my body and see myself as worthless and not having any value. And that would be a slow process, really, as that kind of took over like a sickness in my being. And then so about 6 months on down the road, I broke up with the first like real boyfriend that I had. And then, you know, and then it was like the anger consumed me. And I was already involved in the punk rock movement. And there were skinheads on the periphery of that. And they were the angriest people in this already sort of angry subculture. And so I was able to identify with their anger and was like, wow, those are my people. Those are the people I want, like, I want to be around.
And it sounds like you're saying,
all you had to do was be angry.
Right. And it sounds like what you're saying is that to fit in and become, as you say, angry, part of learning to hate other people was learned. That was part of fitting into that group. Is that accurate?
Yes, I believe that is accurate. And for me, it wasn't a big step because I hated everybody. And so in a strange way, it was almost a relief to make my anger and the rage that I felt smaller and more focused, that instead of just raging with everything and just all the time, it was like, well, all I have to do is say, join in and say, I hate black people, I hate Jews, I hate all non-white people. And so it would be a process of that, but that I understood that was the price of admission. And it was almost a relief because it took this big amorphous, ineffable rage that I felt and at least gave it a name.
So I want to play you this comment. We talked about hate groups earlier this week, and this is a psychology professor from the University of Maryland named Ariai Kuglansky, and he's talking about why it's not a good idea to mock a skinhead or someone who is a white supremacist.
If you mock their beliefs, they're going to push back. There's going to be a blow up. There's going to be a boomerang effect. So you must be careful not to offend their beliefs. You have to reach out to them, listen to their concerns, and provide the alternative ways of thinking.
What do you make of that mocking is not the right approach?
I have 7 kids, so I am able to toe the line of saying, hey, the behavior is unacceptable. Like, what you are doing and putting forth is not acceptable on any level. But let's talk about what you believe. Let me hear you and not talk past you and not belittle you, because you clearly have a reason that you believe so strongly about this that you're willing to, you know, join a rally in Charlottesville or wherever the rally might be, or engage online. Like, you clearly hold this belief dear to you. So instead of being like, wow, you're just a worthless piece of trash, very likely they already believe that. And saying that causes an embattlement. If you refuse to truly hear someone and where they're coming from, that the tendency is to become defensive almost immediately. And so it will be completely ineffective if you are truly trying to dialogue with someone, even with an abhorrent point of view, if you just mock and belittle them, and you will entrench them further. If shame is at the root and disconnection from others and a sense of objectifying other human beings is at the root, then objectifying the person with whom you're trying to dialogue just exacerbates the problem, and there's just a deepening cycle of disconnect from others.
Well, on that note, let's bring Sammy Rangel into the conversation. He's the executive director of Life After Hate, which is a nonprofit group that helps people move away from violent extremism. And Sammy joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, Sammy.
Good morning.
So I want to play another comment from Ariai Kuglansky of the University of Maryland, a psychology professor, talking about the fact that people, just like Shannon, but people who are extremists are actually redeemable.
You know, radicalization is not a terminal disease. In the same way as a person gets radicalized, he or she can get de-radicalized, and they can also get re-radicalized. You know, the human psyche is a very fluid, malleable kind of entity.
So what do you make of this, Sammy? Because we're living in a time when people say there are some people you just can't talk to. What's your response to that?
Well, I would say you're talking to one right now, and, you know, our Formers Network within Life After Hate in other areas of work that I do is full of people who were deemed, diagnosed as incorrigible, antisocial, sociopathic, And many of the members of this group were the leaders and the faces of these hate groups, these extremely violent groups. And yet today, if you were to sit down with any one of us, if you didn't know our background, you would never guess. And if you did know our background, you might be amazed at the transition and the transformation that everyone has gone through and is going through in order to maintain that. And we're still seeing that trending coming with the people that are even newer to our organization, to our former's group, that they are deeply in this process of transforming their narratives and their lifestyles. And in the way that they see that they need to give back to the community is second to none, if you ask me.
And we only have about a minute here, Sammy, before we take a short break. But do you agree with both Shannon that mocking is or shaming is not productive?
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, we're noticing a trend that has reemerged where this collective shame may be contributing to some of the radical feelings and ideas that people are developing currently right now in the alt-right.
We're speaking with Sammy Rangel. He's the executive director of the nonprofit group Life After Hate, and also Athens resident Shannon Martinez, who was once a skinhead. If you have ever confronted somebody with racist beliefs, tell us how that went. Or maybe you're one of those people that says those people are despicable and you can't talk to them. Give us your response. You can call us at 404-500-9457 or just reach us on social media. We continue this conversation in just a moment. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. We're talking about how to reform extremists. My guests are former skinhead Shannon Martinez. She lives in Athens, Georgia. We're also talking with Sammy Rangel, the executive director of the nonprofit group Life After Hate. And again, a word of caution, parts of this conversation may not be suitable for everyone. And I feel kind of dismissive calling you just former skinhead Shannon Martinez. What other title should I use for you?
I also volunteer with Life After Hate. The most interesting thing about me is that I'm a mom.
Of seven.
Yes, of seven.
Yeah, that is quite an amazing achievement. You have to have the patience of a saint. But
no.
let me talk to you, to both of you about...
It's true.
I know. A new poll that just came out today, this is from the Washington Post and NBC, that says the number of people who think neo-Nazi views are acceptable has now doubled since Charlottesville. Shannon, why do you think that is?
I think a lot of that has to do with packaging and marketing. When these views, when confronted, the default position, as it was for me over 20 years ago, as it is today, is that, well, we're not really racist. We want to have everyone to have their own little areas where they live and where, you know, like where we don't think we're better than people of other races. We just want to have our own little space where we get to just do white people things and everyone can do their own ethnic things in their own little area, and it's not really about racism. And at the same time, they also say, well, you know, there's Black Pride and Black Lives Matter. Don't our lives matter too? Don't we count for something? And people resonate with that because they don't really understand what the arguments truly are. Because what the argument really is we're white and we're better and we don't want to be polluted, so to speak, by the ongoings of people that don't look like us.
So, Sammy, let me play you this comment. These comments from former Atlanta mayor and UN ambassador Andrew Young have become controversial. Here he is speaking on NBC's Meet the Press.
The reason I feel uncomfortable condemning the Klan types is they're almost the poorest of the poor. They're the forgotten Americans. They have been used and abused and neglected. Instead of giving them affordable health care, they give them black lung jobs, and they're happy. And that just doesn't make sense in today's world.
What do you make sense of that argument, Sammy?
I guess just being straightforward, I don't make sense of that. But what I do think is happening in alignment with what Shannon is saying is that a lot of the people that are feeling marginalized right now, who are newer to the so-called movement, do feel like there are some social injustices that have come out of like civil rights movement type initiatives that have tried to balance out the scale because of overt systemic racism in our historical racism in our country. And so it's a twist of the truth in a sense where we're saying that, well, because of like issues like affirmative action, whites are being denied jobs. Well, the problem with that is that we have to acknowledge history. We have to acknowledge that there was a reason for trying to balance out the system. But what they're actually saying is playing on feelings of people who feel a little bit, who have some sort of grievance with the way politics are going, with the way their lives are going, the way things seem. And then they find a way to send this message that, hey, we're with you, we're on your side, but you also have to adopt some of these other beliefs. Quite often, many of the people that I'm talking to who are still on that other side, their grievances are almost cookie cutter. You can almost predict what their grievances are going to be. And it's almost like they think they're thinking for themselves, but their comments and their viewpoints are kind of that rhetoric, are kind of like scripted for them, and then that's what they're pursuing. And so these groups feel like they're victims, and they also feel, when I was talking about collective shame, they also felt very removed from the days of slavery, very removed from the days of World War II eras. And so they're wondering why they're still carrying the burden of their ancestors and almost feel as if it's unfair of anyone to put that on them. And it's, I'm not debating whether it is or not, or whether or not there's any validity to that. But if we're going to try to understand how to dismantle some of this hate, we have to understand where their grievances are coming from as we move forward.
So we have a tweet from Lindsay who says, there's a massive difference between listening and tolerating. I think too often people confuse the two, which leads to more radicalism. And let me play one more comment. This is from an African-American blues musician named Daryl Davis, and he's sort of made it his job to go around convincing KKK members to quit.
The fact that a Klansman and a black person could sit down at the same table, enjoy the same music, that was a seed planted. So what do? When you plant a seed, you nourish it. And I decided to go around the country and sit down with Klan leaders and Klan members to find out, how can you hate me when you don't even know me?
Shannon, we only have a minute left, but what is the best advice, one thing somebody could do if they end up talking to someone who hates?
I think to help them feel truly heard, validate their viewpoint, and make it absolutely unequivocally clear that you do not agree, and that in America, that level of hate and objectification of other human beings is unacceptable.
But hear them out.
Yes, hear them out.
That
you you can't fight an enemy you don't know.
That is former skinhead Shannon Martinez, mother of seven. She lives in Athens, Georgia. We also spoke with Sammy Rangel, who's the executive director of the nonprofit group Life After Hate. Thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.